Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and this week's show is brought to you by Senetas. This is a company that has traditionally made Layer 2 encryption gear, but as you'll hear, they're moving with the times. Senetas CTO Julian Fay, he's one of my favourite sponsor guests, and he'll be joining us to talk through a bunch of stuff, what they've been working on. He'll also talk about a really interesting project they had to abandon because of COVID, and I kind of insisted he talked about that because I knew about it. We'll get the latest news on the move to quantum-resistant crypto. That is a really great interview, and it is coming up after this week's news, which starts now. And Adam, I mean, what a sign of the times when we've got the United States, the President of the United States, regularly commenting on ransomware. You know,
it's kind of funny that that's what it's taken. You know, because I mean, cyber has been important and hacking has been important for a long time, but we really are at the point where it's a headline issue. You know, part of international relations, and yeah, seeing this, you know, in the Washington Post, for example, you know, talking about what Biden said to Putin about ransomware, and yeah, I mean, it's a crazy world.
I mean, is this another case of the IRC smack talk, like extending further and further up the government influence chain?
I guess so. Yeah. You can slap Putin around with a bit of a, you know, wet trout like in the old days, and we'll see what happens.
That's right. And look, a big bit of news that broke overnight is that Reval has disappeared from the internet. A lot of people are sort of getting a bit excited here and suggesting that maybe this is because the United States or its allies have taken action against the Reval crew. Although I did have a chat with Dmitry Alperovich. Of course, he was a co-founder of CrowdStrike and these days runs the Silverado Policy Accelerator. It's his feeling that these guys are probably just chilling out down at the beach. Here's what he had to say.
So, of course, we don't know what's going on here. It could be a lot of things, but here's what I think is most likely. I think it's summer in Russia. Moscow can get very, very hot. It's actually quite hot right now. Black Sea resorts, particularly on newly acquired Crimea, are very appealing. And you can go swimming in the Black Sea. You can go fishing. Lots of things to do, great vineyards there as well. So I think these guys are thinking it's time to pack up, spend some millions that they've just acquired down in Sochi, down in Crimea, and come back refreshed for the fall and maybe do a rebrand and launch new campaigns. It could, of course, be that FSB is putting pressure on them and forcing them to shut things down, but I don't think it's particularly likely. And the thing to watch to confirm that is if we will start to see other groups like DarkSide, Conti, and others really start to shut things down, not just our evil. So we'll have to wait and see. But for now, let's enjoy at least one group taking a break.
Yeah, so I guess they're down there in the vineyards, drinking some nice wine, doing a bit of fishing, you know, spending some time on the beach. I mean, it does feel kind of like the most plausible explanation, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they've just pulled off a big scam, you know, make some money. You got to spend it at some point. You got to kick back, relax.
I mean, it's about work-life balance, really, isn't it?
Exactly. It's really important. You know, they can have a, you know, corporate retreat maybe, you know, get some massages, talk about strategy, you know, make some plans, you know, get things together. And yeah, as Dmitry says, maybe it's time for a rebrand. You know, they've done that before. They've taken a bit of a break. So yeah, why not?
Kaseya, meanwhile, this news beggars belief. It's a post on KrebsOnSecurity.com. Adam, tell us about this further data point that suggests Kaseya are information security world champions.
Kaseya's old customer portal, portal.kaseya.net, was running some of their own software that had, like back in 2015, like a path traversal bug, a post, the nominally post auth path traversal bug that lets you read some files off the disk, blah, blah, blah. Turned out they hadn't actually patched their own software. They hadn't, you know, applied their own patch to their thing. They said that it was an old version of their portal that they just kind of forgot to turn off and, you know, waved some hands. But yeah, this is kind of embarrassing when, you know, obviously they just had, you know, all of their customers, well, a small portion of their customers allegedly owned. Yeah, to have people identifying that they hadn't even applied their own patches to their own software, not a great look.
No, definitely not a good look. Meanwhile, they have released a patch for their VSA server, you know, on-premise VSA servers that enabled this big Reval campaign. That patch was announced on July 11. My reaction to that on Twitter was, do they also have a time machine and where can we buy tickets?
Yeah, I mean, given that they got notified about those bugs, what, like back in April, was it? That, you know, maybe they could have I mean, obviously, once things started rolling, maybe they could have, you know, put the pedal to the floor just a little bit, got the patches out, maybe a little bit quicker, but... Oh, dear. I mean, I presumably all of their customers have at least got the message already that perhaps it's a bad thing and perhaps they should, you know, think about what they've done.
Now, look, we've got a bit of a theme this week and we're sort of, you listeners are going to pick it up as we go. The ACSC here in Australia has announced that a bunch of Australian organisations have been compromised via a vulnerability in ForgeRock. I don't know too much about ForgeRock, Adam. Tell me about it.
So ForgeRock is a, well, ForgeRock and an associated open source product, OpenAM, provide the sort of like identity aware access proxy that you'd bolt in front of your web app to do integrated single sign-on, that kind of thing. So, you know, authentication thing, kind of important that it works well. It's a horrible, big, nasty mess of enterprise Java. Someone had a rummage through, found some pretty classic kind of Java deserialization bugs in it that, you know, lead to straight up code execution. So that's been pretty bad because obviously by design, it's the sort of thing you would put on the internet, and by design it arbitrates access to other things, so code exec there is exactly what you're looking for. And the fact that this was traced back to a Java component from Oracle from 20 years ago, like it's the Sun component of the old Sun 1 stack, which literally is 20 years old, the fact that that's in a modern access gateway, not super great as well. But yeah, a bunch of people, you know, this bug has got, kind of gone a bit under the radar compared to some of the other stuff lately, but you know, the people who are getting owned with this are getting proper owned.
Yay! And look, we can add one more victim to the Excellian victim pile, and that is Morgan Stanley, according to this piece from Ars Technica.
Yeah, this piece talks about some customer data from Morgan Stanley being exposed. But what's interesting is this breach is actually through a third-party provider to Morgan Stanley called Guidehouse. So a great example of, you know, when you outsource some technical aspect of your business, not being able to outsource the responsibility and having your name in the headlines. A kind of interesting angle of how this has been reported.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing that that Excellian thing just turned out to be, I mean, we're still hearing about it 6 months later, more sort of marquee victims, but anyway. And look, continuing the theme, can anyone guess what it is yet? There are some major problems with Dell's Wise Management Suite.
Yeah, this is Dell's tools for managing their set of thin clients, which they still brand as Wise, which is funny because I mean, Wise made serial terminals in the 80s. I think I have a Wise 120 somewhere in my stash. Nice old piece of equipment. But yeah, it's still a thing. And yeah, this was an interesting set of bugs because you could exploit, it's in the management software for these terminals, and you could exploit it from the terminals themselves. And so many places use thin clients, you know, because of the improved security of not running a whole bunch of software out on the edge. But the idea that you could walk into a bank branch and use a, you know, a thin client kiosk to then hack the management thing and then from there pivot onwards into the rest of the environment, pretty smooth.
Yeah, I mean, there are some environments where it still makes sense to run thin client stuff like this, like embedded device thin client. And it's places where, say, you've got a really dusty environment, like in a manufacturing plant or something like that, you know, having something that doesn't have fans in it is usually a good move. I remember having this conversation, right, with one of the companies that makes this stuff. And I'm like, why? How are you still selling this? And that was what they said, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly, you know, you can get lots of low-power machines. And I mean, these days, these are mostly embedded Windows, right, running a Citrix client or something like that. Mm. So pretty functional, you know. It's exactly the experience you're going to get on a desktop for most people anyway. So you can see why they still exist. But, yeah, it's just kind of funny in this case seeing them getting owned from the thin client that you probably used for, you know, its reduced functionality.
If people haven't guessed by now, the theme this week is that enterprise software is garbage. By the way, just wonder no more. The mystery is solved. And speaking of that, Microsoft has actually, well, they did push out an emergency fix for this print spooler bug. They pushed that out about a week ago, and then the Patch Tuesday release has just come out, and that emergency release is now contained in the July Patch Tuesday. But this whole thing has prompted Caesar to issue an emergency directive that would force American government agencies to disable print spooling, basically the print spooler software, until they can actually patch it, right? So, and that's a heavy-handed thing, you know, because they have to do this. It's mandatory.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly a pretty big stick to use and, you know, straight up, some quite tight deadlines on this as well. So there's going to be a bunch of people working pretty hard to make sure that they have done the recommended steps, you know, across all of the systems that the US government relies on. But yeah, it kind of shows how important this stuff is, you know, and, you know, we've come a long way over the years from the sort of, you know, really wishy-washy guidance to now, you know, quite a big, you know, you will do this and you will do it in, you know, a few days. And, you know, that's a pretty important milestone to get to where this is what happens.
Yeah, but they have to have disabled the principle of stuff by Wednesday, July 14, and they have to have applied the patches by next Tuesday, right? So, and I think this is really just a way of, yeah, forcing people to maybe not up, you know, go through their usual patching process, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Caesar says it's aware of active exploitation. You and I spoke about this, was it last week or the week before? And it was pretty clear it was going to get some love.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great bug, right? It's exactly what you want in terms of reliability. It provides you the privilege escalation in a domain environment that's super useful. Like, it's just, yeah, we're going to see this for a long time because of the ubiquity of printing and old Windows and the, you know, the bug itself being, you know, there's no memory corruption, there's no lack of reliability, right? It's exactly, as an attacker, what you want in a workhorse bug.
Yeah. Now, speaking of workhorse bugs, but this is like time warp stuff, right? Microsoft has found a bunch of bugs in SolarWinds. Well, they discovered a zero-day in SolarWinds being exploited in the wild, but these bugs are pretty, you know, facepalmy.
So this is actually a bug in SolarWinds product ServView, which is a name I have not heard in a very long time. That was like an old Windows FTP server from the like late 90s, early 2000s, which I didn't know that SolarWinds owned. So it kind of brought back some
memories. Now, when they say secure FTP, do they mean actually SFTP or do they mean secure in quotes and then FTP?
I think these days it actually does literally do SFTP and does, you know, literally probably do FTP over SSL. But no, I mean, they mean secure in air quotes, obviously. And traditionally this was just a straight up, you know, port 21 classic FTP server. Anyway, now it's a whole, you know, secure file transfer solution. And also a way to get yourself owned. So that's kind of funny. The bugs themselves, I think this one was a memory corruption maybe, but I mean, the fact that they're seeing active exploitation of this does suggest that SolarWinds intern has been busy writing code as well.
Now, Andy Greenberg at Wired, I think, has done a really good job here writing a bit of an explainer to his audience about this whole class of enterprise management software and why it's kind of introducing quite a lot of risk into environments these days, which I think, you know, I'd like to see more coverage like this, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good kind of explanation for regular people as to why this kind of stuff matters and why you would find, you know, why you look for bugs in it, why attackers care about it. And also, I mean, I guess some explanation of the level of complexity involved in modern enterprise management solutions. And, you know, Kaseya is obviously far from the only, you know, type of product like this. There's a whole bunch, you know, obviously Windows Active Directory in itself, you know, is the biggest one of these. And we as attackers really love anything that lets you, you know, reach out and touch a whole bunch of machines all at once using normal channels, like things that are meant to work, using credentials that already work and network flows that are already expected. Like that's a thing we really love, you know, just follow the admins around and use their tooling. And yeah, this kind of explains why this has got focus. And you know, there's been plenty of other products that have had, you know, had bugs in them that are in this kind of same category. And we've used, I mean, I'm trying to think over the years how many times we've ended up using this type of network management stuff to move around laterally. So yeah, good explainer for everybody else why this matters and why it's a really fruitful place, you know, for bug hunters to go looking.
I mean, it really does seem like at the moment the biggest risks people are facing in the sort of, you know, ransomware context, well, in any context really, it's from your border devices, right? So things like VPN gateways, firewalls, things like that. And then you've got your MDM stuff, which is also a disaster if there are bugs there. And then you've got other stuff like your IT management software. These categories of software, I mean, the bugs we're seeing in them, I've got to admit to being kind of like dismayed that there's so many dumb bugs in them. I mean, I shouldn't be because, you know, I don't know what got into my head that maybe things had improved, but it's beyond the joke at the moment, isn't it? Like it just is absolutely beyond the joke.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, your expectations about things improving is based on things like browsers and operating systems, like the traditional targets of bugs from the 2000s. You know, in the old days, obviously, we used to do server exploitation, you know, via ServView FTP, for example. But then we went to that period where browsers and operating systems were the real targets. And we've got, you know, a whole bunch of sandboxing and exploit mitigation tech in the operating systems and in the memory allocators. And, you know, we got this expectation from the operating systems that things were getting better. But of course, the software further up the stack and especially complicated enterprise stuff that's kind of, you know, tends to be built by, you know, there's very little security incentive to improve, a management product that just does a whole bunch of, you know, kind of complicated boring day-to-day work. Because
it turns out there is an incentive, Adam.
Well, it turns out there is now, yes. But I guess where I'm heading is that there's never been the evolutionary pressure from a security perspective on applications further up the stack that there was on browsers and operating systems. And now we're seeing that apply.
I think there's another dimension to this, which is that the QA processes around business software. Business software is not distributed to the same level as things like browsers, right? So you're obviously going to have much more robust QA processes around browsers, you know, office suites, things that get deployed to gajillions of endpoints or servers, you know, IIS, Apache, things like that. Like they just wind up with more eyes on them, right? Because of their criticality. Whereas, you know, of the 20 or so most popular MDM solutions, who's putting eyes on them?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I saw a tweet from Dave Attell yesterday saying that, you know, the advantage that APTs have is their willingness to do the boring stuff, right? Yeah. To build test deployments of all that boring enterprise software that you've got to have a license for and you've got to deal with, you know, all the pain in the ass of setting that up. And that's, you know, every time we've looked at enterprise software, the hardest part is having a representative test environment and understanding the software enough to exercise it so that then you can go and find bugs and you understand what normal looks like. And that's way harder than finding bugs in any piece of enterprise management software. You know, I'm thinking like I've looked at management software and say, you know, banks and ATMs, like getting a test ATM, getting all of that stuff set up, that's hard work. But once you're in that position, finding the bugs is often days. And yeah, the stuff isn't distributed widely. It's not easy to get test systems, right? It's the same argument in, you know, a bunch of other niche industries as well. And historically in the, you know, operational tech, SCADA kind of spaces, access to the gear and test environments wasn't common. And we've seen, you know, efforts like the, you know, SCADA ICS Village and stuff and DEF CON changing that up a bit. And yeah, I mean, this sort of enterprise software is, you know, I don't know if we've ever really stopped and looked at it enough with enough eyes. I mean, that OpenAM bug, just being classic Java serialization, like nothing's changed in 10 years, is because nothing changed in 10 years in that software.
Yeah, yeah. I've got an interview in the can that I'm going to publish hopefully later this week with the NSA cybersecurity director, Rob Joyce. And we had a little chat in that interview about how the United States government might apply pressure to vendors to do a better job, right? Because they're, you know, the United States government is such a big purchaser. But how's this for a policy idea, Adam? If you want to sell to the US government, you need to do two things. You need to set up a test environment that bug bounty people can go at, and you need to kick some money into a bug bounty pool that is administered perhaps by, you know, the US government in partnership with one of the bounty platforms. How's that for an idea? And that way, there is a test environment that people can go hack at, and they will find stuff like the dumb SQLI in the, you know, pre-auth SQLI in the login page. I mean, that sounds reasonable. What do you think?
I mean, it's certainly a great place to start. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of enterprise software that I feel like there's better methodologies than black box, more efficient methodologies and better coverage than black box, but that is absolutely a great place to start. I mean, bug bounty kids and bug bounty environments, you know, are definitely going to smack out some of the dumb stuff. And, you know,
That's the thing, right? I don't think we have necessarily the scale in the industry right now to do a line-by-line review of all of the enterprise shitware that's out there. You know, I just don't think that's possible. But the idea that you would force people to make their software available to test and force them to actually put some money into a bounty pool, and guess what? If you run out of money out of your bounty pool, maybe you're going to lose some contracts with the government.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly would be a great place to start. I could think of ways to structure it that I do think would probably go better, but I mean, that's...
Tell me what they are, because I'm into it.
I mean, for example, that OpenAM bug, right? Finding that requires that you understand a bunch of the internal plumbing of the software, and doing that blind from the outside is, you know, probably not going to happen.
But isn't that open source?
So in that case, it is, and that's why the bug was found, because that component was open source. But I'm thinking, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that isn't. Having access to the underlying software, being able to go introspect it, you know, because I mean, whenever you're doing hacking, the first step is identify all the entry points. And if you can't do that, then it's really, in a lot of enterprise software, it's very difficult to map out all of the exposed functionality. It's really typical in Java enterprise crapware that you do need to go read the internals of the web server of the Java servlet config, servlet engine config, find all the endpoints, find all the servlets mapped, find all of that kind of stuff. And then you can use that to go find low-hanging fruit real fast.
So could you define a manifest that these organizations would have to publish alongside their test environment? I know we're just talking pie in the sky here, but believe me, there's probably like 10 people listening to this who are really interested.
I mean, the best thing in the case of big Java enterprise software, the best thing is to have access to the at least the jars and be able to run it through a decompiler and go read it. Because that methodology of enumerate the endpoints and then read each entry point until you find auth or input validation or deserialization, that's a technique that gets you shells real fast in really, really complicated bits of software. And that's a like that's what we do, you know, if we're looking at that kind of thing, versus trying to do it black box, trying to do it without, I mean, even access to, you know, just the configs, you know, would be useful, but being able to really rapidly review the source, your decompiled source, is just, it's the by far the most efficient approach. And I would, you know, it'd be a pity to see a whole bunch of time and money wasted on black box approaches that aren't going to get the kind of coverage that enterprise really needs.
Yeah. No. You're making absolute perfect sense. I just wonder how the vendors would feel about that. But then I'm kind of at this point with their track record, I'm beyond caring.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, at the very least, a list of all the entry points and a list, like a manifest of all the component, all the dependencies, you know, if you're reviewing Java stuff that's got 1,000 dependencies, understanding, you know, what version of Spring or Apache, you know, some Apache components or whatever else in there would certainly give you a bunch of useful hints.
But you see, you see why I think the bounty model in some form could actually be quite useful here.
Yes, I mean, I do. I think it's a good idea, and I think it would be a really great place to start. And then you would get an indicator from that, you know, kind of how effective that approach was and where the gaps are. And then you can come up with methods to try and deal with some of the more efficient approaches to doing, you know, large-scale auditing of software.
We are, of course, available for by-the-hour policy consulting to anyone in the US government who would like to, hit Adam up. That'd be great. Just let us know. Now, what are we going to talk about, Adam?
Let's say China.
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 That's right. We're going to talk about
China.
We're going to talk about China. We've got a late-breaking story here from the American ABC News. This story is kind of thinly sourced by the looks of it. It came from Joe McDonald, who's an AP business writer, and it says that, like, China is going to outlaw people selling O-Day or passing it on to foreigners, and they must give it to the government. But then elsewhere in the story, it says they can also give it to the vendor. So it's a little bit confusing as to what exactly is happening. Apparently, this is law or regulation or whatever that's going to come into effect on September 1st. But it, as I say, I'm treating this story like a little bit carefully because it just doesn't quite track, if that makes sense. Was that your feeling reading it as well?
Yeah, like I was looking for some sourcing to go read, you know, read some original material because it did seem like it seems like quite a big deal, and it does seem real thinly sourced for something that is such a big deal.
I guess it's not a big deal if you're a business writer for AP, right? Like
maybe
you might not understand that there's a whole bunch of nuance there.
Yeah. So, I mean, the story says, under the new rules, anyone in China who finds a vulnerability must tell the government, which will decide what repairs to make. No information can be given to overseas organizations or individuals other than the product manufacturer, and no one may collect, sell, or publish information on network product security vulnerabilities, which, you know, one of my work colleagues said, well, that now's the time to go into pwn2own because the majority of the competitors are you're not going to be around next year to steal all your thunder. But yeah, I mean, if you were a pen tester or a vuln researcher, you know, in the private sector capacity in China right now, that would, you know, if taken on face value, that doesn't seem super great.
But yeah, you're sunk.
Well, but maybe that's already the kind of effective case and it's just being codified now. I don't really, you know, I guess I don't have enough experience on the ground in China, but, you know, what happens if you're an employee of a company that's based in China, but you're not necessarily there, you know, in country? What effect does that have? There's a bunch of questions here that we just, you know, we don't really know enough about to answer.
Yeah. So, I mean, are you supposed to contact the vendor or just give it to the government and then they decide? Like, it's just, as I say, it's not super confusing. Clear, but I'm guessing by the time we record again next week, we'll have a clearer idea. Staying with China, and a crew is targeting online casinos that are popular with Chinese people, which is interesting in and of itself, Adam.
Yeah, so this is attributed to APT41, the Winty Group. They've been seen going after, you know, Chinese gambling sites. And, you know, because this is a group that we've seen kind of doing the Chinese government's bidding in the past, the fact that they're then hitting domestic Chinese targets, you know, would immediately, you know, on initial thinking, seems a bit kind of unusual. I mean, you know, we certainly know if you're a Russian hacker crew, you probably don't hack targets in Russia, and you'd imagine the same would apply in China. But of course, gambling, this type of gambling is actually not legal in China. So the idea that this could actually be a state-sponsored action.
Well, I wouldn't think it would be state-sponsored, but I'd think it would be sort of state-approved, if that makes sense. Like, yes. Yeah, go for it, do whatever you want, you know, we don't care.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Phone the police, right?
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. But yeah, interesting twist, I guess. I mean, we have seen them operate domestically against, you know, some of the oppressed, you know, like Uyghur population, for example. But yeah, going up against gambling, I guess if they make money out of it, what are they going to do?
Just a point of order, Adam. Every time you say the Winty Group, a threat intel researcher pops a vein because it is like the most poorly defined quote-unquote group in the world. We even ran a whole post on it last year about how like everybody calls Winty different things. Is it a set of behaviours? Is it a crew? Is it a, you know, so it's what trend is calling Winty / APT41. But that word, just Winty is the one, it's like a trigger word for them, man. It's
don't at me.
do at him. Microsoft has paid out in the last year $13.6 million in bug bounty rewards.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, you know, Microsoft's, you know, in a pretty big place in the industry. You would expect them to be paying out a reasonable amount of money.
But that's a little bit more than I expected. I got to be honest. That's a lot of cash, man.
That is a lot of cash. I think the biggest reward they said was $200K, which is for a Hyper-V, you know, virtualization bug. The average is about $10K, which, you know, when you consider how important some of these bugs in Microsoft software are, I mean, that print nightmare one, like, think about how much that bug is actually worth in terms of what it's costing us to go fix it and issue emergency directives from Caesar and whatever else. Like, if Microsoft paid $1 million bucks to buy that one.
Yeah, I guess for every dollar they put in, they're probably saving $100 harm in the wider community. So that's a nice thing. What do we got here? We've got an indictment. This is a Dan Gooden story from Ars. The feds in the United States have indicted a dark web info broker named The Bull for selling insider stock information. You noticed that in this story, they don't really talk about him actually earning all that much money, which is sad for The Bull. The thing that I found interesting in this is right down towards the end of the story, it talks about how prosecutors alleged that he had misappropriated information that he was then on selling, but they don't say how it was misappropriated, which I found a bit mysterious. But yeah, another use for the dark web, selling insider information to shoddy stock investors.
Yeah, he doesn't seem, this guy was from Greece, he doesn't seem to have made a whole bunch of cash out of it. And as you said, like, it didn't, if he was doing computer hacking to get the data, perhaps they would have charged him with that. But it does seem that maybe he was just collecting, maybe buying tips from insiders or getting early access to press releases, you know, pretty normal low rent stock fraud. So information to help people defraud their stocks. But I guess his OPSEC wasn't so good.
I sold amazing stock tips on the dark web and all I got were these handcuffs. The UK is going to let the United States argue again that Julian Assange should be extradited to the US to face espionage and computer crime charges. He's been in Belmarsh for a couple of years now, and as much as I loathe the guy, I'm starting to feel like the United States should maybe let this one go.
I mean, yeah. I mean, he's, you know, certainly been deprived of his liberty quite a long time now.
No. If your mum is going to spank you and you run and hide in your cupboard, right? Hiding in the cupboard doesn't count as punishment, Adam. Okay. So he has not been deprived of his liberty.
This is the Ecuadorian cupboard.
Yes, he has not been deprived of his liberty for a long time. He's been deprived of his liberty for a couple of years. But given the most crimey crime that he's alleged to have committed was the conspiracy around that password hash and Manning and all of that, you just sort of think, well, I mean, 2 years seems like probably enough for that. I mean, I think the espionage counts are, you know, interestingly written and argued in the indictment, but you just sort of think, I mean, he's done some time now. Like, at what point are you satisfied?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, well, I guess we'll see how this particular round of appeal goes. But, you would hope that, I don't know whether he's learned lessons. I mean, is that the point of going to prison in the US? I'm not sure if it is. But, you know, yeah, it's just been a long-ass time. And, yeah, as you say, like, maybe it's time to just, I don't want to agree with the Free Julian people. They were protesting down the street, like, just a few weeks ago.
Oh yeah, no, he's I still think he's there aren't even words, right? And his supporters as well. But at the same time, like, at what point have you got your pound of flesh? That's just what I wonder, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Can't jail people for being annoying, you know? Although, when you and I take over, when the revolution comes, maybe we'll look into that. Now, we've got an interesting story here from Catalin Kimpanu, talking about how Spam House actually took some information pertaining to compromised email accounts, like 1.3 million email accounts, and worked behind the scenes to secure those accounts. And these were accounts that were compromised by via Emotet. And this is just a really interesting case of an organization doing something behind the scenes to try to mitigate some of the harm caused by a botnet.
Yeah, according to the reporting, they talked to something like 22,000 domain owners to get individual email accounts' passwords reset. I think they said 60% of the 1.3 million email addresses that were on the list that they got the subset of Emotet compromised accounts have now had their passwords changed, which, I mean, that is a lot of work for, you know, a lot of presumably not particularly great email passwords. But, you got to take your hat off to them for doing what I imagine was not particularly glamorous work.
No. Not my definition of glamour anyway. Now, look, we're going to close out with a couple of skateboarding dogs here, Adam. The first one, I find this really, really interesting. Apparently, there is an ad being played. Well, there was an ad being played on YouTube here in Australia, which featured two very prominent and popular breakfast TV hosts chatting about, you know, Millionaire's Secret Revealed or something. It's like a scammy ad, right? And there they are sitting on their couch in their set talking about this stuff. It's a deep fake, right? So the voices, it's like probably just an impersonator. Apparently they did a half decent job, but it would be enough to fool a bunch of people. Now, when we first started talking about deep fakes a few years ago, it was all this stuff about like, oh, there's going to be deepfakes of world leaders and, you know, this is going to be the thing. And here we are. What does the reality of deepfakes look like? Low-rent, scammy ads impersonating breakfast TV hosts on Australian YouTube.
Oh, it is. It's a wild cyberpunk future that we live in because, exactly. Like you'd expect, you know, faked public statements from, you know, prime ministers and world leaders and, you know, but no, here we are. It's like pornography and scammy advertising. That's what we use deepfakes for.
Yeah. You're putting all those computing resources into pretending to be Karl Stefanovic. That is just mind-blowing. So that's one for all of the policy wonks to go have a look at. It's just a tweet. Matt Bevan, who's the host of the excellent China If You're Listening podcast, which I highly recommend, by the way. It's fantastic. He was tweeting about it and, you know, tweeted with a screen cap. And, yeah, wow. 2021 is amazing. And then finally, I found this one courtesy of Troy Hunt's Twitter account. It links off to a Register article about a law firm that, Adam, and I think they've cracked it. I think they've figured it out. They've come up with an idea that, yeah, I think they may have solved ransomware. Tell everyone what they did.
So this barrister's chamber was hit by ransomware people who took their data. They went and got a court order, ordering the people unknown who had taken their data to not release it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, problem solved. I mean, why didn't anyone else think of that? You know, and I bet they sat there after they filed their paperwork and just felt so satisfied. You know?
The job well done, you know, dust off your hands, time to go down to the members only club for a, you know, nice glass of sherry.
Yeah, you were gonna say pub, but no, you know, these people do not drink in pubs.
Exactly.
They go to the club.
They go to the club.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. It's actually a short one this week. I love this time of year because the United States is all everyone's just, you know, spending some time in the sun and relaxing. So we don't have quite the normal workload to process on our end. But that was all really fun stuff. And I look forward to doing it again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay, who is the Chief Technology Officer of Senatas. And Senatas is a company based in Melbourne, Australia, that makes Layer 2 encryption gear. So if you need a Layer 2 100 gigabit per second full line rate encryptor, they're your people. But as you'll hear, they're making some changes to some of their products so that they can handle encryption at different layers simultaneously. You know, you might want to have one device handling your layer two stuff while you've got a connection to public cloud over here and whatnot. So yeah, we talk a little bit about that, but we also talk about some of the embedded products they've been working on that have applications in things like legacy ATM fleets and also ICS environments. And then we have a conversation about the status of the global switch to quantum resistant encryption. So there's lots of good stuff in here. Julian's great talent. He's such a good conversationalist, really. I barely have to edit his interviews. So here is Julian Fay talking about their new multi-layer encryption technology.
If you think about kind of how the enterprise WAN has developed, you know, pretty much for 30 years, they were all being designed the same way. You'd buy some sort of carriage service from a telco, you'd backhaul all your branch offices to some sort of central point of control, and then from there, you'd go out onto the internet when you needed to. But you know, what we've really seen in the last 4 or 5 years, and this has been accelerated, I think, by COVID and people working remotely, is a far greater move to internet-based connectivity, cloud-based access, and the evolution of technologies such as SD-WAN and Secure Access Service Edge, which are, you know, there's a kind of common, a simple narrative that the traditional WAN is dead and everybody's just buying sort of internet bandwidth and going onto the cloud. What I'm seeing is something far more nuanced than that. It's more complex. It's a sort of hybrid mix of public and private cloud services. So you've still got your traditional corporate data centers and they still need to secure data at 100 gig and coming up 400 gig pretty soon. And they're still using some carrier services, but they're increasingly complementing that with, you know, internet connectivity straight into public cloud access. And what they need is solutions that meet all of those touch points from a security and particularly encryption perspective. So what we've been trying to do is evolve our core layer two capability, which, as you said, was really pretty niche, into a much more flexible solution that allows us to address all of those emerging use cases. So this is a feature that we've rolled out across our hardware platform, as well as through our software virtual solutions and a cloud gateway product that we brought to market as well. And simply put, it allows us to encrypt data independently of the underlying network transport. So whether you're running across a high-speed fiber or you're running across some sort of poor internet access point, we can now encrypt that data. But more than that, we can actually encrypt it at different layers in the stack.
So you can be encrypting at layer two and above at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. The critical point. Based on the sort of application, the traffic flow, so you can define a granular policy that says, okay, this traffic is going over a high-speed optical network. We can encrypt that at layer two because it's most efficient and you don't need to expose the IP headers. This is going into a cloud gateway, so this needs to be encrypted at layer three because it's going across the public internet. Or this is going across some service where they're doing policy-based routing or they're doing some sort of QoS markings. So you actually need to encrypt that at layer four. So you actually might leave the UDP or TCP headers in the clear in that instance.
So this is like a multi-in, multi-out kind of deal, not necessarily just like a simple border device.
No, you don't just say, okay, this is a device that's encrypting at layer three. It's not all or nothing. It's a granular policy engine that allows you to intelligently apply the most appropriate encryption layer to meet the needs of the data security, but also the underlying network that it's going over, which I think is very aligned with the kind of SD-WAN philosophy that networks are kind of evolving to.
It's funny, right? Because, you know, we like to think that it's this amazing cloud world now, but you're right. It's a big mishmash out there. It's why vendors like F5 still make money, right? Is because, you know, these environments are complicated and there's a lot of legacy stuff intermingling with the new stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And look, it's not as simple as the traditional WAN's dead and we're just all going to use the internet. In some ways, it's more complex than it used to be because, as you said, you have this mishmash of different technologies. And the challenge I think organizations are facing is that they're going to have different solutions to address each of these points. So, you know, how do you encrypt your 400 gig data center optical traffic and encrypt something going over the internet into the cloud? That's a real problem. How do you manage that? How do you manage your keys? So we're trying to build up our portfolio to really have a good range of solutions that can address those different touch points. And this network independent strategy has been critical in our thinking with that regard.
Now, you've actually had some success with this on a European project that I understand you can't talk about who the customer is or anything, but can you tell us what the sort of requirements were and how you addressed them?
Yeah, so it was as a central European country. It was a critical infrastructure project with very sensitive traffic that had to be sent over it. And the customer, that they're a large government-owned entity, they were using a hybrid sort of infrastructure architecture, but to meet the the performance and the security needs of this particular project, they essentially built their own MPLS cloud. And their requirements were such that they needed a quite sophisticated encryption scheme that would sit right in the middle of that MPLS cloud. It needed a group key encryption mechanism to meet all of their topology requirements. And it essentially needed encryption at layer 2.5 in this instance, which was something that we would not traditionally have been able to do. You know, we could have encrypted the Ethernet layer, but this was deep in the core of their particular MPLS bit of that.
You just reminded me of being John Malkovich, you know, go to the seven and a half floor.
Yeah,
you know?
The little mezzanine encryptor, perhaps. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I should recall it, rebrand it, that or something. So this, what was really satisfying from our perspective was that it was really a good example of where our strategy seemed to make sense for this particular customer, because we couldn't have done this a year ago without, you know, the features that we had in our product that were layer 2 only. So by being able to bring this new greater capability to the customer and fit well within that environment, it was a good validation of the approach we've taken. So yeah, I'm very pleased to see that happen.
Yeah, so this is going to be available in all your 100 gigabit per second full line rate encryptors, I'd imagine.
So we're rolling this out across all of our hardware devices. In fact, it's just coming out now as a firmware upgrade in our FPGA appliances. So this will be a no-cost firmware upgrade to our customers of our hardware appliances. It's just simple FPGA firmware upgrade. But we're also adding it to our software and virtualized encryption solutions as well. So it'll be across the product portfolio.
Now, your 100 gig is still the biggest you're doing right now, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. I was talking this morning about requirements for 400 gig, which are starting to emerge, but quite slowly. I think we're probably still a couple of years away from seeing a real urgent requirement for sort of 400 gig infrastructure.
It's very funny though, because it's always the case, like when you came up with your 10 gig boxes, like there's a delay of a couple of years and then all of a sudden people start ordering them. And it's kind of been the same with the 100 gig stuff, right? Because it's been slow. But I was talking to one of your colleagues the other day and they're like, no, they're going okay now.
No, that's really actually taken off in the last 6 months, and in Australia as well.
But they've been out for 2 years. This is my point. Like, you guys always release this stuff, and then it's crickets for 2 years, and then all of a sudden everybody wants one.
Yeah. Well, like, it's a real balancing act, because if you bring a product to market too early, you risk kind of choosing an obsolete technology.
Yeah.
Which means the product's going to be inferior and going to cost too much. But if you bring it out too late, then you've missed the boat. So that's always the sort of challenge of our business, is when do we actually commit at the right point in time. But yeah, look, it's been great. Look, the 100 gig, actually in Australia as well, we've got a massive growth in Australia over the last 6 months, which might be a bit of a sort of post-COVID infrastructure bounce,
yeah,
I guess, within telcos and government. But that's, certainly been very pleasing to see.
Well, there's one thing I want to touch on too, which is actually something at the opposite end of the spectrum. And look, this is a project that you guys were working on that actually got squashed because of COVID, which made me sad actually, because it's a very cool little idea. You've also been able to squeeze some of your crypto smarts into a very small, low-cost hardware device. And the idea behind this project was you were going to a developing country and you were going to extend the service life of a whole bunch of ATMs that were hideously insecure and couldn't really be locked down by funneling all of their traffic through one of these tiny little encryption devices. But this is also using this like multi-layer approach. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So look, we identified a real requirement to kind of increase the resilience of sort of installed ATM base in Asia, in a couple of countries there, where there was some regulatory requirements coming down the road where they actually had to add encryption. And they had a kind of rip and replace option to rip out all the ATMs in country at massive cost, or to add some sort of security overlay. So we came up with a solution that we have actually brought out to market, which was an implementation of our encryption engine in a hardware appliance, but at a much lower cost and price point to address that inline encryption requirement to address that encryption overlay need. And that was also sort of foundational in driving this strategy around network independent encryption, because a lot of those ATMs, you know, they connect over pretty crappy internet services. It could go over some sort of shoddy ADSL link in the middle of some rural area, or perhaps a satellite link. And you've got to deal there with different quality of services and dropouts. And it needed a bit more of a sort of sophisticated approach for the encryption side. So that was also driving our thinking around that. So as you said, unfortunately, that project didn't really go anywhere, because we're kicking it off just around the start of COVID. But it has really been foundational in driving the strategy and the product features for what we're about to release.
Well, it's funny, because we were talking about what to talk about during this interview, and you're like, no, that project fell over, it's such a shame. And I'm like, there's probably some people listening to this who would quite like to hear about a small low-cost hardware device that could extend the life of a legacy ATM fleet. I'm expecting you'll get an email.
We'll see. Yeah. Well, we're taking that same idea and we're building a kind of ruggedized version of that same appliance because
that's for ICS applications, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've been talking about that for years and it's never happened, right? So is that coming? Is that coming soon?
Yeah, so that's something we're actually working on at the moment. That's a platform that we're basically adding our encryption capability into. So it's a ruggedized existing appliance that we're turning into a tamper-proof encryption inline encryptor, kind of in line with the ATM one, but with much greater environmental.
Dust-proof.
Soundproof, dust-proof, jog-proof, all that stuff.
Oh, man. Yeah. Now, look, one thing you did send me before we got going on this is a topic we've spoken about quite a lot on the show, is quantum-ready encryption. You sent me a very, very long PDF containing all sorts of information and thinking on how the transition to being crypto-ready is going. First of all, what is that document? Its name escapes me right now and who did it. But and then tell us what's in it, because I did skim it. I didn't have time to read the whole thing, but it did look like, some people have put some real time, effort and thought into this one.
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to this quantum stuff, as you know. So this was a document from, it was combined from NIST and the National Cyber Center of Excellence in the US, which is a document they only published in June. It's well worth reading out, seeking out and reading. You can find it on their website. It's called A Migration to Post-Quantum Cryptography. And it basically outlines a path that organizations can start to consider in building quantum resilience. And it outlines a number of steps that are sort of practical steps that organizations, in their view, should take and consider, which I think, well, firstly, it's a well-written document. It's really interesting. It's the start of a sort of project to kind of collectively generate a greater sense of urgency, I think, amongst us all in terms of migrating to post-quantum security. And that's something that I feel strongly about. I do think collectively we do need actually a greater sense of urgency to start thinking about and implementing practical steps.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, that's one of the things that shone through in that document in the parts that I read, is it's like, okay, so here's what we need to do. It's no longer, hey, we need to start thinking about this. It's more of a best practices, like this is what you need to be doing now kind of vibe, right?
Yeah. Look, and the reason, there's a couple of reasons I think that's particularly important. I mean, we all know the risk. We know that all the encrypted data that we secure today is quantum vulnerable. It's basically got an expiry date. But the scale of it is probably not well appreciated. I mean, this is an internet scale problem.
Yeah.
It kind of touches every point in our digital lives. Even a small business has a massive technology base.
I mean, if you think Windows XP legacy was bad, this could be a lot worse. Yeah,
a lot worse, yeah. And then I think the biggest problem is that very few organizations have a good working knowledge of where encryption and the keys are being used and stored in their environment. Much of it is opaque. It's kind of like this giant cryptographic iceberg where all the keys and it lies beneath the surface. Today, there are no really good tools that you can open up that kind of show you at an organizational level where your keys and your use of cryptography are. There's no kind of magic crypto dashboard.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that this document talks about, is that we're going to increasingly need tools to manage data lifecycle.
Well, it's almost what you're talking about is like asset inventory, but for which ciphers and keys and, that's what you're talking about there. Yeah.
Well, firstly, you need discovery, right? You need to discover where these things are. So I think we're going to see an evolution in a whole bunch of cryptographic data and key discovery tools. Then you need an inventory for it. So you're going to have asset and data lifecycle for use of public key cryptography in the environment. And then, so you need to discover those algorithms and keys. Then you need to classify them. And I think you need to classify them both with regard to sensitivity, but also in terms of their shelf life, because everything is quantum vulnerable that is encrypted today. And if you're talking about temporary credentials, your shelf life might be a few hours. If you're talking about trade secrets or classified data, it might be a few months. But if it's your DNA sequence, it's your lifetime, right? So there's very different life cycles that our data assets need, and that needs to be factored into the classification.
We should point out, too, that you guys are already shipping some quantum-resistant stuff, and because a lot of this stuff isn't certification-ready, you're actually like double encrypting. So you're encrypting with the FIPS-certified stuff and then wrapping that around some quantum-resistant stuff and shipping it out just to give people that peace of mind.
Yeah, that's right. That's hybrid classical combined with the new emerging quantum algorithms, which is what NIST themselves recommend. So you can do that today. with ours and with other gear. And that's a sensible mitigation strategy. But
you don't have to rely solely on the quantum resistant stuff, which hasn't been around for very long. You know, it's just a nice added bonus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good defense in depth strategy, I think.
One thing we want to touch on too is this survey that you guys did. I mean, we don't normally talk a lot about surveys on the show because, you know, there's not usually that much that's interesting that gets thrown up. And a conversation about percentage stats doesn't generally really fire people up. But there were a couple of numbers that really stuck out for me. And one of them, and I can't remember the number, you'll have it there in front of you, but some ungodly number of people seem to think that their firewalls handle encryption.
Yeah, so look, there's a survey sent out to IT and cyber decision makers in global organizations. About 500 people responded to the survey. And nearly half of the respondees, about 42%, said that they either don't encrypt their data or that they don't know if they encrypt it. And of those who do know that they encrypt it, 75% of those said that they basically turn on the encryption that's in their firewall or in their router, basically whatever's in the existing infrastructure. So what that says to me is they're not necessarily making an informed decision about the type of encryption that they want to use to protect their network. They're turning on whatever's in the existing infrastructure, which may be fine in many instances. I mean, there's perfectly good VPN.
But it also, I mean, the whole thing to me means that they're really muddy on what it means, like on what network encryption actually means. So does that mean that they're using the encryption in the VPN component, or does it mean that they think once their traffic goes through a firewall, it's magically encrypted somewhere? Like, it just, to me, the thing that I walked away from with that document was just like, oh my God, there's a lot of management types out there who really don't get how this stuff works. And actually, you know, people being armed with the knowledge of what some of these common misconceptions are, that could be actually quite useful.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think it speaks to a lack of strategic focus on encryption as part of the sort of cyber defense as a specific tool. And, you know, the truth is, as you and I know, not all encryption solutions are the same. They vary in degree of security, impact on network performance, and hidden operational costs that can have a real impact on business performance. You know, are you using a pre-shared key that you type in once and is never ever rolled over, for example? Mm. What kind of overhead is the encryption put on? So it kind of speaks to a sort of lack of nuance or discernment in really actively going out and picking the most appropriate solution for the organization. I'm not for a moment saying there's anything fundamentally wrong with using IPsec that's in a router or a firewall. There are some great solutions on the market. But I think every organization has some sort of optimal strategy that they need to take into consideration when it comes to security and performance. And this survey kind of indicates maybe they're not paying as much attention to that as they should.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Julian Fay, it is always such a pleasure to have you on the show. It's been a little while. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. I always learn a lot when we speak. And yeah, we'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks, Patrick. Great to catch up.
That was Julian Fay, the CTO of Senetas there. Check them out at senetas.com, senetas.com. And yeah, as you can probably tell from that interview, I get along great with Julian and his colleagues as well. They're all wonderful people down there in Melbourne. And I'm a little bit sad that COVID has resulted in sort of travel restrictions in Australia because I have missed being able to go down and have lunch with the Senetas people in Melbourne because that's always so much fun. But anyway, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back, I guess, in a day or two with that interview with Rob Joyce. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.